right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. President Trump is preparing for his Monday meeting with Russia's leader. AP's Ben Thomas has more.
President Trump is spending the weekend at his seaside Trump Turnberry Golf Resort in Scotland. Aides have said he's busy preparing for Monday's summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. But that's not keeping him off Twitter. He sent out tweets hailing the job market and Friday's bump in the Dow, blaming his predecessor for election hacking, and saying he's been hate-watching CNN. He's also acknowledged playing some golf, which has attracted protesters, including Mary Crows.
It's just dangerous. It's ghastly. And we want to show our protest, because if you just say nothing, it's okay.
Police kept the protesters at Turnberry a distance from the president, but they were within sight and did get a wave from him. I'm Ben Thomas.
The United Nations says the conflict in Afghanistan killed nearly 1,700 civilians in the first 6 months of 2018, the highest number recorded in any comparable time period over the last decade. Islamic State plotted suicide and other attacks caused 52% of civilian casualties, mainly in the capital, Kabul. At least one person is dead and several others wounded after a siege on a Nicaraguan church where about 150 protesters, priests, and journalists took shelter after coming under attack by paramilitary forces. Church officials negotiated a release of the captives, mostly students, after they spent Friday night trapped under gunfire in the Divine Mercy Catholic Church. The students were then taken out of the church and transported to the cathedral. Supporters lining the streets cheered as buses carrying the students passed by. The siege came after a protest calling for the resignation of President Daniel Ortega Thursday in a nationwide strike on Friday. This is VOA News. Israel launched what it termed its most powerful attacks against Gaza's dominant Hamas group as militants in the Palestinian enclave fired dozens of rockets across the border. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
After consultations with the defense minister, the chief of staff, and Israel's top defense officials, we decided on powerful action against Hamas terrorism. Israeli armed forces delivered the most powerful blow against Hamas since the 2014 Gaza war. We will increase the intensity of our attacks as necessary.
Two Palestinian teenagers were killed in one of the more than 40 airstrikes the Israeli military carried out in Gaza since Friday. The military said about 100 rockets were launched from Gaza at southern Israel. A human rights watchdog says Egyptian authorities are increasingly using counterterrorism and state of emergency laws in courts to unjustly prosecute journalists, activists, and critics for their peaceful criticism. Human Rights Watch said Sunday the abusive practices and distortion of counterterrorism measures happened while Egypt was chairing one of the United Nations committees to ensure compliance and counterterrorism resolutions, and while the UN's most senior counterterrorism official was visiting the country. Some cases, according to the rights group, have been transferred to the emergency state security courts that the government claims are being used only against terrorists and drug traffickers. An activist says thousands of protesters have fanned out in Iraq's southern oil-rich province of Basra to protect a lack of public services and the shrinking job market there. There have been similar protests across the country. Basra protests boiled over last week when security forces killed one protester and wounded five others. British police say search teams have found more than 400 items as part of the investigation into the poisoning of two British citizens by the Russian-made nerve agent Novichok. AP's Karen Shamus reports.
Metropolitan police said they had found a small bottle believed to be the source of the nerve agent that killed Dawn Sturges and sickened Charlie Rowley. The small bottle was found during searches of Rowley's house, and police have interviewed Rowley in recent days since he recovered consciousness. Police are still looking into where the bottle came from and how it came to be in Rowley's house. Further tests will be carried out to establish whether it's from the same batch that was used to poison Russian ex-spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter in March. Karen Chamas, London.
Generals from the United States and North Korea have met to discuss the repatriation of the remains of U.S. soldiers who fought in the Korean War. Michael Minahan, an Air Force Major General with U.S. Forces Korea and the Chief of Staff for United Nations Command, met with the North Korean general Sunday at the border village in the demilitarized zone. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
In the public that there is a meeting at the State House, so the State House has not formally issued a statement that there is a meeting and perhaps provide details of what their discussion will be around.
Former U.S. President Barack Obama arrives in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Sunday.
In terms of weapons, for example, used by the soldiers, it's hard to be mistaken. And the video clearly shows weapons only used by the Cameroonian army, and we found no evidence of Boko Haram.
The Cameroonian government rejects the latest Amnesty International report.
In fact, if the buck stops at the President Lungu to stop this violence, if the Commander-in-Chief of the police and other armed forces, if we meant to stop the violence, would have stopped it.
And the Zambian Electoral Commission dismisses a request to postpone the Lusaka mayoral election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Former U.S. President Barack Obama arrived in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Sunday. The former president met with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta after his arrival and later also met with the main opposition leader, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. Mr. Obama is scheduled to open a center for knowledge, learning and excellence in Kisumu. The center, officials say, will aim to enable the youth to realize their potential by having access to the internet and books to encourage reading. For more about Obama's visit, I read Moses Nyamori, a reporter with the Kenyan Independent Standard newspaper, who was at the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport when the former U.S. president arrived.
The former president, Barack Obama, arrived here some 20 minutes ago and is already at State House where he's supposed to meet President Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya. And we are informed that the former U.S. president is also scheduled to meet opposition leader Raila Odinga at his Capitol Hill offices. We still at the airport, and it's a stark contrast compared to when the former U.S. president came to Kenya in 2015. Today, there is not much activity going on here, save for some short disruption of traffic flow at the airport. The traffic was stopped for about 5 minutes when the former U.S. president was leaving the airport some 20 minutes ago. So not much activity compared to what happened when he visited Kenya in 2015. In his second visit as a former U.S. president.
We understand the former president is also supposed to be in Kogero. Tell me about that plan.
The former U.S. president is supposed to be in Kogero. That is the rural home of his late father, Barack Obama Sr. That there, the main key highlight of his visit to his ancestral home is the launch of a foundation by his sister, Dr. Pamela Obama. Basically, that foundation is called South Yangu, basically dealing with projects to promote youth things to do with sport, informal training for youth in the area. Kogelo is in Siaya County, so that's the highlight of his visit before he again leave for South Africa.
What has been the talk in town when Kenyans got the confirmation that former U.S. President Barack Obama was visiting Kenya?
To be honest, there is not so much expectation compared to when he came here in 2015. You know, at the moment, he no longer holds the office of the U.S. president. So whatever is there is just the excitement that the fact that his father is from that particular area. So it's the excitement that one of their own is coming to visit them. And of course, with that particular project, there is not so much excitement in terms of what the locals expect. For them, it's their son or one of them is coming to visit them.
What is the significance of the meeting between the former president and Raila Odinga, the main opposition leader in Kenya?
Of course, as you can remember, the country underwent a very fierce political contest which pitted Raila Odinga and its arch rival in the 2017 presidential election, the incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta. So ideally, coming at the backstop of a unity pact between the president and the opposition leader, Raila Odinga, we expect the leaders perhaps to discuss the unity of the country moving forward. And of course, currently there is a renewed fight against corruption, which is being spearheaded by the two leaders after their famous handshake of March 9 this year.
Has the government said anything about the meeting between President Uhuru Kenyatta and the former U.S. president? Because currently they are in a meeting at the State House.
There is no formal communication, but it's out there. The former U.S. president was just driven from the airport to State House, and of course is in the company of a cabinet secretary, foreign affairs, and of U.S. ambassador to Kenya, Robert Godek. And it's in the public that there is a meeting at State House, though the State House has not formally issued a statement that there is a meeting and perhaps provide details of what their discussions will be around.
Moses Nyamori is a reporter with the Kenyan Independent Standard newspaper. He spoke with me from Nairobi. Meanwhile, 200 delegates from 68 countries around the world gathered in Nairobi, Kenya, to discuss piracy threats off the coast of Somalia. The three-day meeting was sponsored by the Indian Ocean Commission with support from the United Nations and the Kenyan government. For VOA, Ruben Chiama has this report from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Officials at the meeting say the threat of piracy off the coast of Somalia has been contained, but it remains a problem which amounted to nearly $1.5 billion in 2017. The participants are all members of the UN's contact group on piracy off the coast of Somalia. Vishnu Luchmena Raidu is Foreign Affairs Minister of Mauritius and the chair of the Indian Ocean Commission.
We must not forget that this contact group has been set up by the Security Council of UN to deal with the issue of piracy in this part of the world. So today we are making a formal proposal that the contact group becomes a permanent organization that will deal with piracy, but also with related issues, issues which are linked directly or indirectly to it, namely terrorism, mainly cross-border crime, and things like this.
The menace is complex since other related crimes, such as drug trafficking and money laundering, represent a threat for regional economies and beyond. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Defense, Rachel Omamo, says other countries in the region need to confront the problem collectively.
Many African countries are unable to stand coast guards on their own. They do not have the resources to establish radars and other ISR capabilities. It is essential that we pool our resources together as we deal with these challenges. We must cooperate beyond our continent because we know that our seas connect each other, and a threat on one side of an ocean can affect a country that is very far away.
The contact group on piracy off the coast of Somalia was set up in 2009 after a decision of the UN Security Council. It's the only forum that gathers all stakeholders committed to deterring maritime piracy in the western part of the Indian Ocean. The grouping of more than 68 states and international organizations evaluates the risk of piracy and mobilizes member states and other actors to find solutions to the problem. Ambassador Monica Juma is Kenya's Foreign Affairs Cabinet Secretary.
Generally, everybody that is a member of the United Nations is a part of this. But in terms of the operations and discussions, as you have heard, there is a representation of 68 nations today in Nairobi. Obviously, there are those of us that are closest to Somalia and that have been engaged on this matter, because we have, by the fact of proximity, we have been very close to it.
The three-day gathering is expected to discuss current issues related to piracy threats and come up with a roadmap for deterring the problem and other related maritime threats. Ruben Chama reporting for VOA News in Nairobi.
Mm. The Cameroonian government has rejected as false a report by Amnesty International that its military engaged in acts of killings, arrest, and property destruction in the fight against Boko Haram. Information Minister Issa Chiromo Bakari said the report was a calculated strategy to destabilize the Central African country. His remarks came after Amnesty International said it gathered credible evidence that Cameroonian soldiers committed unlawful killings, destruction of private property, arbitrary arrests, and torture of civilians. For more about the report, I reach Ilaria Allegrozzi, a researcher with Amnesty International in the Italian capital, Rome.
We received a video which displays the execution of two women and two very young children, one girl about 7 years old and one baby boy. We have spent lots of time at Amnesty to go through the video. We watched it multiple times, and we also consulted sources on the ground and compounded their testimonies with the analysis of our experts, including military experts and researchers on weapons and ammunition. We came up with the conclusion that the perpetrators of these brutal acts are the Cameroonian soldiers. The video depicts Cameroonian soldiers using weapons which are really consistent with those used by the Cameroonian army, including Kalashnikov-style rifles, including Zastava M21. And this is really belonging to the Cameroonian army. Also, in terms of landscape, we have been able to determine that the video was filmed in the Mayo Sanaga area, which is in the far north region of Cameroon. And in fact, the vegetation displayed in the video is consistent with the reported area of the incident. You can see terrace cultivations, you can see rocks, mountains, shrubs, which can only be found in this the far north region.
I understand officials of the government have dismissed the evidence that you said you have analyzed, saying that this is just a propaganda to tarnish the reputation of the Cameroonian army, particularly as it faces security challenges in the country.
Well, we stand by our findings, which are the result of a research methodology which is very thorough. We do not get facts out of papers, social media. We do our research on the ground, and we collect first-hand information. We use our experts to help us identify weapons, ammunition, uniforms from the soldiers. The fact that the authorities dismissed the video as fake news is shocking, is concerning, because it casts a shadow over the impartiality of the investigation that they promised to open. We think that instead of making dismissive claims, the Cameroonian authorities should instead address the burning issue and improve their human rights record, comply with their obligations under international humanitarian and human rights law.
Some of the officials are saying that the Amnesty International saying it has documented crimes under international law, some amounting to war crimes, is an indication that the Amnesty International has a target on the Cameroonian administration, and this is part of the plot to tarnish the reputation of the government and to make the government unpopular ahead of the upcoming presidential election. How do you respond to that?
We respond by highlighting the fact that Amnesty International is an impartial and independent organization, and that we have documented both crimes perpetrated by the Cameroonian security forces and crimes perpetrated by Boko Haram in the far north, as well as by the armed separatists in the Anglophone region. We have documented violence going on from both sides. And we have always highlighted the fact that the civilians are paying the highest price in the context of the fight against Boko Haram and in the Anglophone crisis.
Supporters of the administration say that the video that you're talking about could be separatists or possibly Boko Haram people dressed in the uniform of the Cameroonian army with their weapons, trying to bring international condemnation to the army just to score political points and just for Amnesty International to take up the matter and increase international pressure on the administration.
In terms of weapons, for example, used by the soldiers it's hard to be mistaken. And the video clearly shows weapons only used by the Cameroonian army, and we found no evidence of Boko Haram having, for example, the weapons used in the soldiers in this video. Also, the video is consistent with other videos that we have analyzed in the past depicting soldiers torturing or killing Boko Haram suspects.
Ilaria Allegrozzi is a researcher with Amnesty International. She spoke with me from Rome. The Zambian Electoral Commission has rejected a request to postpone the upcoming October 22 election for the mayor of the capital, Lusaka. This after the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, asked for the postponement of the poll, citing concerns of ongoing violence. Local media report of politically related violence during campaigns ahead of the election. The opposition party says supporters from the ruling party, the Patriotic Front, or PF, are to blame for the ongoing violence, an accusation the party sharply denies. For reaction about the request to postpone the election, I read Charles Kakoma, spokesperson for the UPND.
Well, we requested that the election for mayor in Lusaka should be postponed due to political violence. In the recent past, in fact, last month, we had an election for a member of parliament in a neighboring district to Lusaka, and there was a lot of violence. And therefore, we anticipated that even in Lusaka, the situation is going to be the same. As we are speaking now, just last night, the ruling PF cadres invaded the home of our supporter in Lusaka and beat up the children together with her and looted her house. And another one was also attacked just last night and broke her leg. So because of that, we said that this election is going to result in bloodshed and therefore it should be postponed. Unfortunately, the Electoral Commission of Zambia has played a blind eye to that. And we know that they are being manipulated by the ruling party. So they refuse to postpone the election.
But Charles, the ruling party accuses the UPND of masterminding these attacks to create tension in Lusaka with the aim of forcing the Electoral Commission to postpone the election because it appears you are not ready, and that is why they say that Miles Sampa, who is their candidate, will win hands down. What's your response to that?
Well, we know that they are banking on the violence to intimidate the people so that the majority of our supporters do not turn out to vote. The purpose of beating up people is to instill fear in our supporters so that they don't turn out to vote. That's why they are doubling with the confidence that they will win in Lusaka. But if there's a free, fair and credible elections, the UPND will win. We have no evidence from them that is the UPND cadres that are instigating the violence, but we have evidence that it is actually the PF cadres who are doing that, and we have captured all these things. They are on camera. Everybody, every media house in Zambia now knows it's the PF that are doing that.
What are you going to do with the evidence that you have, particularly when the Electoral Commission has turned your proposal down to postpone the election? What's your next line of action?
Well, of course, we are reporting all these things to the police in the first place so that the police can be able to control the situation. So far, they've not arrested anyone. And secondly, we're documenting these things so that in case there's an election petition, if the matter goes to court, we'll have the evidence. So basically, we're collecting that and compiling that information for that purpose.
President Edgar Lungu, while campaigning for Miles Sampa, the candidate for the PF in the mayoral race, said that the elections will not be postponed because of one person who is determined to become president and would use all kinds of methods, including violence, to destabilize the upcoming election in Lusaka. How do you respond to the president?
Well, basically, he has missed the point. The issue here is not about one man. And by that, I'm sure he's referring to the UPND president, Hakainde Hichilema. The violence is not about Hitler. The people that are being beaten, that are being hacked, are innocent people, innocent citizens, are not targeted in the Hitler. So it is in the interest of Zambians that this political violence must be kept. In fact, if the backstops at President Lungu to stop this violence, if the commander-in-chief of the police and other armed forces, if we meant to stop the violence, would have stopped it. But so far, we have seen the PF cadres moving in the streets, in the open, during the day, with machetes, guns, and so on. And he's not putting a stop to it. He has not even had anybody arrested for that.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. New York City is a world capital of business and food, and sometimes the business of food itself is what takes center stage. That was the case at the annual Summer Fancy Food Show earlier this month, as over 2,600 exhibitors from over two dozen countries showcased their wares, hoping to snag retail and distribution deals. VOA's Adam Phillips filed this report on some of the Africa-based products on offer.
The exhibition space of New York's Javits Convention Center was bursting with over 200,000 attractively displayed food and drink items. Each one was vying for the attention of an estimated 34,000 food fans.
I enjoy it. Why wouldn't anybody enjoy it? You got 200,000 foods here that you can walk around, you can taste, so it's a great place to be.
That's Ron Tanner, an executive with the Specialty Food Association, which makes all this happen. The countless small startups here selling everything from chocolate to organic fizzy sodas, exotic cheeses, and hand-pressed olive oil seem especially close to his heart.
People can start a business with a dream. Sometimes I say with a dream in a T-shirt. This is where a lot of brands have started, brands such as Kind Bar, such as Pop Chips, such as Evian Water.
Bonolo Monte co-founded Maunga Craft in Botswana in early 2017. She and her two partners take indigenous southern African fruits like marula and baobab and pair them with contemporary flavors to create unique award-winning jams.
We see ourselves as artisans because we get into the kitchen and then we go, what if we pair this, that, and the next thing you know, we're creating flavors.
Monte offers a reporter a delicious baobab and onion concoction, followed by a savory marula and ginger jam.
Am I making you hungry?
Yes.
Yeah, good. And the fruit is also known for making the elephants a bit drunk.
Thrift, paired with ingenuity and altruism, have yielded delicious results for the company. Oil pressed from the marula fruit is used for face creams and other cosmetics. Usually, the pulp is thrown away.
So we were like, hang on, wait a minute. That's a byproduct there that we could use. So we formed symbiotic relationships with small business owners who make oil. And then we buy the pulp from them so that we're using the entire fruit. And so they also hire people in the local community to go pick the fruit. Our vision is to play a role in diversifying the economy and also employment, because youth unemployment is a big thing.
The seemingly endless rows of colorful booths here might be overwhelming, but the many samples on offer more than compensate. The sounds of ooh and yum are everywhere. Cashew nut lovers are crowding the Sunshine Nut Company exhibit. An American candy executive started the company to create jobs in Mozambique. Spokeswoman Tracy Clark says the company now boasts 50 full-time employees who grow, shell, package, and ship the cashews themselves. She says that's what makes Sunshine's nuts so flavorful.
Most cashews, if they're grown in Mozambique, they're shipped over to Vietnam or another country to be shelled, and then they're shipped somewhere else to be processed. With every transportation, it disintegrates the quality of the product.
Zamroot is a tiny Zambia-based company that makes super moringa leaf powder. Because its leaves are filled with nutrients, many African cultures call moringa the miracle tree. But co-founder Krishma Nayi simply calls it a superfood.
It's full of antioxidants and vitamins. It has high contents of iron, calcium, potassium, vitamin A, K, E, you name it, it's there. People have been eating it in Zambia and large majority of Africa for generations now. It's got a light, earthy flavor, so you can add it to your soups, your juices. You can use it on a salad as a dressing. Yeah, you can go as wild as you want.
Super Moringa is a fair trade product, organically made by local farmers.
90% of them are women, and they go and hand-pick the leaves, which are then washed and air-cooled dried, no machines, and they crunch them up, and they sieve it through, and that's the powder that we get.
In an increasingly health-conscious society, foods that offer good nutrition and taste good can equal profit. For VOA News, I'm Adam Phillips at the Summer Fancy Food Fair in New York.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. At Wimbledon 2018, South African Kevin Anderson won the second longest match in Wimbledon history by outlasting American John Isner to reach the men's final. They slugged it out on center court for 6 hours and 35 minutes before the eighth seed came through 7-6, 6-7, 6-7, 6-4. The final set alone lasted for 2 hours and 50 minutes. The Isner-Anderson match smashed the previous record for the longest semi-final at Wimbledon when Djokovic needed 4 hours and 44 minutes to beat Juan Martín Del Potro in 2013. It's the third longest match in tennis history, falling short of the 11 hours and 5 minutes that it took for Isner to beat a Francis Nicolas Mahu 70-68 in the fifth seed in their first round match at Wimbledon in 2010. Anderson, who was runner-up to Nadal in last year's US Open final, becomes the first South African man to reach the Wimbledon decider since Brian Norton in 1921. Now the 32-year Anderson will face Novak Djokovic in Sunday's final. Djokovic will play for his fourth Wimbledon title after beating world number one Rafael Nadal in a five-set semi-final match that took an extra day to complete. In the 53rd career meeting between the two players, Djokovic, the number 12 seed, held on for a 6-4, 3-6, 7-6, 3-6, 10-8 victory Saturday on center court at the All England Club. Djokovic, who has 12 Grand Slam titles, also improved to third all-time with his 13th career victory against a player ranked number one since the world rankings were introduced in 1973. The total match time was 5 hours 15 minutes, making it the second longest semi-final match in terms of duration in Wimbledon history. It was the first time in the Open era that both men's semi-finals went past 6-all in the deciding set of a Grand Slam event. It also was just the second time in the Open era that both men's semi-finals at Wimbledon went to 5 sets. The other instance was in 2001. In the women's singles, Angelika Kerber beat seven-time champion Serena Williams. The German came through 6-3, 6-3 to claim victory on center court and win her first Wimbledon title, denying the American a record equaling 24th Grand Slam in the process. And in athletics, at the IAAF World Under-20 Championships, Kenyan Selifan Cheptegei on Friday night cruised to gold in the 3,000 meters steeplechase in 9:12.78, a championship record. With that, she became the first athlete to successfully defend her World Under-20 title this week. The time was all the more impressive in light of the conditions and early pace. After torrential downpour in the hour before, the track was still soaking wet at race time, and the early pace appeared to negate any chance of a fast time. Ugandan challenger Peruth Chemutai came through well for second, while Bahrain's Wilfred Yaviev needed the line badly in third, paying heavily for her early exertions as she scored 9.23.47. Kenya's Mercy Chepkirui was a distant fourth, with Agri Balechu leading the Ethiopian duo home in fifth. The first non-African finisher was USA's Alice Hall, who finished seventh. And in a thrilling 5,000-meter final, Kenya's Edward Zakayo took gold. The quality of the final was such that reigning champion Salomon Barega from Ethiopia, considered one of the most watertight favorites across the championships, was run out of the reckoning altogether in an almighty sprint for medals on the last lap. Kenya has already won the 1,500 meters, the 5,000 meters, and 10,000 meters at the championships on the men's side, with more chances to enrich their medal haul in the 3,000 meters steeplechase and the 800 meters finals. By contrast, Ethiopia only won a bronze in the 10,000 meters and were shut out of the medals completely in both the 1,500 meters and 5,000 meters finals. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Din 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 din, todi di. Nanipa nafasi kuendelea, na sababu ya kuamini. Unatakiwa uishi, oh, bila kujali wanafikiria nini. Sababu siangali nyuma, na sitoru. Some here, not to see me TV. Din 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 din. Din din din, knock your roll, knock your roll, knock your roll.
souvenir d'un Mambo.
Yeah,
ah, on a fait mal là-bas, hein.
control. Yeah, you say you want take control, control. The way she they do me up there, by control, control. See the way you they roll it up there, by control, control. See my baby want to take control now.
I woke up with a fear this morning, but I can taste you on the tip of my tongue. Alone without no warning, you're by my side and we've got smoke in our lungs. Last night we were way up, kissing in the back of the cab, and then you say, love, baby, let's go back to my flat.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The remarkable rapprochement between Ethiopia and Eritrea continues, and Africa should embrace it. Yesterday, President Afwerki arrived in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, after an absence of 20 years. This three-day visit of the Eritrean president is returned for the visit last week by Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to the Eritrean capital, Asmara. In during that visit, both presidents signed a peace agreement ending two decades of a state of war. And that opened up many, many possibilities. The restoration of diplomatic relations, restoration of transport links between the two countries, possibly the reunion of families separated for so long, and access by Ethiopia to Eritrean key ports, Ethiopia being a landlocked country. This remarkable change of attitude by Prime Minister Ahmed is important in its historical context. Both President Afwerki and former Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Meles Zenawi, were close friends who cooperated in their fight against the Dirk of Ethiopia. And in the early years after their victory, they worked very closely together. This commentator worked with them extremely close because both men called on him to try to help solve certain irritation in their relationship. But there was no doubt that outside powers created division between the two countries. Now the realization is clear that the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea serves no useful purpose for the peoples of both countries. It is therefore good that both states are now moving in a peaceful tradition. This may also open up the possibility of change in the domestic situation in Eritrea. One of the main irritants for many Eritreans is the compulsory recruitment of young men to join the army, and many of them fled the country because of that. The authoritarian rule of President Afwerki may also be linked to this state of war between the two countries. So Africa should watch closely the visit taking place now between Ethiopia or President Afwerki and hope that other African states who may have difficulties will learn from the two leaders. But we must give great praise to Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed because it was an initiative in accepting the solution of Badme that made it possible for us to be witnessing this very significant visit now going on in Addis Ababa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if a blind man says, let's throw stones, be assured that he has stepped on one. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Ebola survivors in Sierra Leone will have some much-needed help in recovering from the deadly disease through the assistance of the United States. On July 28th, U.S. Ambassador to Sierra Leone, Maria Brewer, gave opening remarks during a handover ceremony of 19 categories of specialized medicines worth $215,000, to support emerging needs and medical care for Ebola survivors. These medicines are a donation from the United States government through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. The ceremony took place at the University of Sierra Leone Teaching Hospital Complex, Connaught Hospital, and underscored the United States government's support for the Ministry of Health and Sanitation health system strengthening efforts during the post-Ebola recovery period. The United States government donation of medicines to the Ministry of Health and Sanitation is a symbol of our greater commitment to promoting and supporting the Global Health Security Agenda, or GHSA. GHSA provides an innovative, proactive approach to prevent, detect, and respond to future disease outbreaks. The medicines will be available in 20 hospitals nationwide to populations covered under the Sierra Leone Government Free Healthcare Initiative. These medicines will help treat a number of medical conditions experienced by Ebola virus disease survivors, which are also common among the general Sierra Leone population, such as eye care, mental health and neurology, ear, nose, and throat conditions, and joint pain. Overall, U.S. government investments in the health sector contribute directly to the new government of Sierra Leone's priorities, as outlined in the new direction, One Country, One People, with a focus on strengthening service delivery and expanding and improving free health care to vulnerable populations. More specifically, by making these specialty medicines available, the Ministry of Health and Sanitation can improve access to specialized care at the national and district levels, which is expected in the long term to strengthen the referral system between primary health care and hospitals. The United States is proud to work with its partner Sierra Leone to improve health care and disease prevention for the wonderful people of Sierra Leone.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.